So this is Poisons in the News, and we're going to talk about what toxicology is and how we can all cover the field much better. Got a great distinguished panel here, and we're just going to start off because time is short. We're going to have a brief introductory discussion as each person comes along here. We're going to start with George Gray, who's professor of environmental and occupational health at George Washington University School of Public Health and Health Sciences. He's director there of the Center for Risk Science and Public Health. From 2005 to 2009, he served as EPA's assistant administrator for R&D. Prior to joining EPA, he was the executive director of the Harvard Center for Risk Analysis and a member of the faculty at the Harvard School of Public Health. His primary research interests are risk characterization, risk communication, and the role of science in policymaking, particularly in characterizing the risks of sparsely tested chemicals, improving the use of scientific information in regulatory decisions, and understanding how risk perception influences decisions about health and safety. He has a PhD in tox from the University of Rochester, which in 1965 became the first school in the nation to offer doctoral training in toxicology. Pedigree there. George?
Thank you, Janet, and thanks for that. The introduction. Hope we didn't use up all of our time with that. I'm sorry. First thing I want to do is say hi to everybody and thank you for your interest in toxicology. It was really interesting to me when Janet and Ron called and said they were interested in a session on toxicology. One thing I will tell you, toxicology is interested in you too. I'm actually here officially and being supported by the Communications Committee of the Society of Toxicology. I'm on that committee. And one of the things that the Society of Toxicology, which is roughly 6,000 government, industry, and academic scientists, wants to do is to figure out how to interact better around issues of toxicology with the public and with the media. So I'm here because we're interested in you. And I hope this can kind of be mutually beneficial. Something Janet asked me to do very briefly is to kind of give an overview of toxicology. So what do we do in the first day of my toxicology class that I teach? The first thing we do is define toxicology. And the Society of Toxicology has a very specific definition. I'm actually going to read it. It's the study of the adverse effects of chemical, physical, or biological agents on living organisms and the ecosystem, and Ron's going to talk about that, including the prevention and the amelioration of such adverse effects. But really what toxicologists do is conduct research to try to understand how living systems work and how things can go wrong. And toxicologists work in a lot of different fields. There are folks who work in academic settings like me. There are people who work in industry. There are toxicologists in government. And really, toxicology is about trying to, as best we can, look ahead and prevent problems from happening. And really, it's a field, as Janet said, it's a new field, and it really grew out of a very practical need that was arising in government and industry, that is, how do we understand the potential adverse effects of chemicals and other agents, and how can we identify those, and how can we try to prevent them? In fact, the Society of Toxicology was formed in 1960, so it's a very, very new field. What toxicologists do, very briefly, and Ron and I can answer questions about this, is try to understand the effects of exposures to usually chemicals, but we look at other things like radiation or physical agents like nanotechnology, engineered nanomaterials, to try to understand by looking at the effects they might have on living organisms, on isolated cells, sometimes on isolated bits of cells like proteins or DNA, to understand what might happen. The standard approach that toxicologists use, and this is one of the important things that I try to get across on day one in my class, is to look at what happens as you give a little bit more of this agent to those animals, to those cells, to those molecular bits. The idea is to develop what toxicologists call a dose-response relationship, and it's really the underpinning of toxicology. If toxicology has one phrase that defines it, it's the phrase that's often repeated, and I tell my class to keep my toxicology card, I have to say this to them on the first day of class, that the dose makes the poison. And the idea is that everything has the potential to be hazardous at some level of exposure. And what we want to try and understand as toxicologists is what level of exposure, and sometimes what conditions of exposure, are necessary to make bad things happen. And that's what toxicologists do. So this dose-response relationship is then used in ways that we begin to care about. It's used in standard setting by the government. It's used in occupational safety and health decisions that are made by companies. That information from those studies is taken and put into a process where we're trying to protect people against things. One of the real challenges we have, and I think this is something we'll talk about, is it's very difficult in the world of toxicology to talk about a word like safe. Safe is a word we'd all like to know. The problem is safety doesn't, our kinds of tests don't define in a certain way what safety is. We have imperfect models. Often we're using animals, mice, to represent people. Or we might even be able to be using cells to represent people, or individual molecules to represent people. It's not perfect. It's the best we have, and we're doing the best we can with the knowledge we have, but it's very different. It's a hard extrapolation to make, but it's one that we have to make. And one of the things that's really important and that toxicologists get a little sensitive about is that this scientific uncertainty is real. And it doesn't mean that they're not doing their jobs well. It just means that we're working with a system that doesn't answer all the questions we want. And with that...
Right on time. Whoa, I'm impressed. Okay, we'll go on to Ron Kendall here. He's the newly named special assistant to the president here at Texas Tech, as well as a professor of environmental toxicology. He founded the Institute of Environmental and Human Health here at Texas Tech University 5 years ago, I believe.
15.
And, 15. Really? Ooh. I have to do my homework a little better. Back at Clemson University, where it was before, he founded and directed the Institute of Wildlife and Environmental Toxicology and the school's Department of Environmental Tox. He was a founding director of the Institute of Wildlife Toxicology at Western University as well, Washington University, and is a past president of the Society of Environmental Toxicology and Chemistry, which has its meeting next month. I'll be there. He's authored more than 200 refereed journal and technical articles and published or edited a host of books on wildlife tox, emerging contaminants and biodiversity, principles for evaluating endocrine disruptors in the environment, and studying things like the toxicity of atrazine and perchlorate in the environment.
Thank you, Janet. It's a pleasure to be here, and I welcome all of you to Lubbock. The day is a typical day in Lubbock. I hope you enjoy the weather. No, our falls are very nice. When Janet talked to me about this session, it intrigues me because not only do I do a lot of scientific and discovery research, I think it's important as an academic to be able to communicate that. So we welcome the opportunity to have you here and to join this session. We identified George Gray here because he represented more of the human health side of the equation through the Society of Toxicology. I, on the other hand, represent more of the environmental toxicology side, although as institute director for the last 15 years, I had to engage both environmental and human health. So, as the past president of the Society of Environmental Toxicology and Chemistry, I can tell you we operate a much different meeting than the Society of Toxicology. Much different. In terms of background, the whole area of assessing the effects of environmental contaminants on the reproduction, health, and well-being of wildlife is a relatively new field of endeavor. In fact, when I was doing my graduate work, there were no wildlife or really environmental toxicology programs to speak of. In fact, in the late 60s, as a teenager, I had a chance to work in the laboratory of a world-renowned insect toxicologist in cotton insects investigation at the USDA. And being a person that was interested in the environment and interested in environmental questions, we had not even coined the term environmental toxicology back then. But all of the focus back then was killing insects with whatever chemical levels you had to apply. And I really mean that. And so I was that little teenager who would raise my hand. I said, what about the birds and the environment and wildlife? They said, it's no problem with those. That stuff is, it's the Audubon people breaking the eggs of the eagles. And so that's when I started to develop a lot of my early professional philosophy. Like, you just can't believe everything you hear. And you need to weigh out and acquire the appropriate information and go on to apply some of your own philosophy and principles towards these questions. So we founded CTAC. I'm a charter member in 1979-80. And then as the field began to grow, we saw, I remember the first SeaTac meeting, I gave a talk in wildlife toxicology, and I think about five or six people showed up, and three of them slept through it. It just wasn't a lot of interest at all. And it's kind of neat as the field grew. We've published a number of books on this subject over the years, but our latest book, in wildlife toxicology was published, through CRC Press, one of the largest science textbook producers in the world. And, it came out right during the Gulf oil spill. So, everybody every night was seeing, birds dying from oil exposure or turtles or whatever else. So that book came out, and within 1 month, the book Wildlife Toxicology, Emerging Contaminant and Biodiversity Issues, within 1 month became an international bestseller. And I actually got a phone call from the vice president of CRC Press, and he said they'd never seen anything like it. And so there was a lot of interest nationally on the subject, and so we got a lot of calls, I probably talked to many of you. We were contacted by the World Press, tied to the oil spill, tied to wildlife toxicology. So anyway, the whole subject is continuing to gain interest because people realize we as human beings are tied to our environment, and when birds are dying or fish are dying or whatever, that's a signal that there may be something going awry. And so we are now in a field that continuing to explode with discovery, and we're starting to put together the signals, whether it be endocrine disruption, whether it be nanotoxicology, the wildlife, the environment does send signals that applies directly to our own health. So I look forward to the session, and thank you for inviting me, Janet.
Next, we've got Dan Fagan over here on my far right. Well, we can go with Lizzie next. Next to me is Elizabeth Grossman. She's an award-winning Portland, Oregon-based freelance writer and journalist specializing in environmental and science issues. A prolific writer, she's authored 4 books, including Chasing Molecules, Poisonous Products, Human Health, and the Promise of Green Chemistry, and High-Tech Trash, Digital Devices, Hidden Toxics, and Human Health. Thank you for not using toxins. Her work has appeared in a variety of publications, including Scientific American, Yale Environment 360, Environmental Health Perspectives, Chemical Watch, and it goes on and on and on. She has been a public policy scholar at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in D.C., a science journalism fellow at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution and Woods Hole Marine Biological Laboratory, and has served on the Communication and Education Work Group of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's National Conversation on Public Health and Chemical Exposures.
Thank you, Janet, for that nice introduction. And I am going to just make a few points from the perspective of somebody who reports. Can you hear me? Or is this mic bad? I think it's just a good mic.
Use mine.
We had problems with this mic in the previous session, so I think. Is that better? Okay. I'm just going to make a few points from the perspective of a journalist who reports on issues involving toxicology practically every day. But one of the things that I thought I would say first off, and it actually came up in our previous session, is that when someone asks me what I specialize in as an environmental and science journalist, I say environmental health, and then I quickly define that as saying it's the health of the environment, and it includes human health, and within human health, public health, occupational, and personal health. So I look at environmental health as this whole spectrum of things. And where I see toxicology playing into my work, which, and it truly happens every day, is my job as a journalist is to figure out how to interpret and translate and summarize some of the latest scientific studies on toxicology that are being published, and how do I present this in a context that is going to make sense to a general reader, because I do write primarily for a general readership. And one of the questions I am always asked by editors, and I'm sure all of you who are journalists are asked this as well, what does this mean for our readers? Why would they care? Is this substance safe? How risky is it? How scared or concerned should I be for myself, for my family, for my children? So it's kind of in that context that I'm being asked to understand the latest in toxicology. One of the things that these latest studies typically involve is the newest science into the health effects of perhaps newly identified contaminants, new health effects, new discoveries of how chemicals are interacting with living cells. And a lot of that involves effects and also contaminants that may not be well identified. So there is a lot of really new science that this has to be put in the context of, and sort of linking back to sort of the world in which George Gray and Ron Kendall work in. One of the challenges as a journalist is how do we put these new contaminants and newly identified health effects into some meaningful context for general readers when there are quite likely no established measures of safety? How do we begin to interpret that? And one of the other challenges that comes up again and again in the realm of writing about toxicology is that idea, the dose makes the poison and the dose response. And based on everything that I've learned in the past 10-plus years of reporting on this, one of the biggest challenges we face as journalists, and I think in this entire field, is defining what that dose means, particularly in the context of all the work that's been done in the last 20 years or so on endocrine disruptors and the recognition of low-dose effects and epigenetic effects, where timing as well as level of dose can play a really profound role in the health outcomes. So those are big challenges. And the last point that I would add to this list of sort of top challenges for writing about toxicology is how as journalists do we deal with studies that may have apparently conflicting results, studies that aren't consistent, or how do you deal with reporting on a purely academic study or what seems to be a purely academic study, or studies and reports that involve both policy and political agendas as well as scientific information, no matter what source they're coming from, whether it's from the NGO community, the industrial community, or indeed academic sources that have particular funding interests or research interests that may cloud the clear lines of sight. So those are my top challenges as a journalist writing about toxicology. And I'll give you a little intro first.
Oh, okay, sorry.
I'm so rare.
I know. I'll make it short then. He's an associate professor of journalism and the director of the Science, Health, and Environmental Reporting Program at NYU's Arthur Carter Journalism Institute. He has a book out next March. That's true, it's next March. About environmental cancer epidemiology on Toms River. Prior to becoming an academic, Dan spent 15 years as environment writer at Newsday, where he was twice the principal member of reporting teams that were finalists for the Pulitzer. He's garnered an award from the AAAS, which is the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and the Science and Society Award from the National Association of Science Writers, in both instances for stories about epidemiology and toxicology. And we at SEJ know him as a former president and board member of our organization.
Thank you, Janet. So is the mic working? Yes? Okay, good. And Janet, congratulations to you on your award, by the way. A really terrific award. Janet is an absolute stalwart of SEJ and has been for a long time. So Janet asked me to just spend a couple minutes trying to put a little sort of journalism-wide perspective on this topic of toxicology and, you know, what's sort of happening in the journalism world right now on tox. And I'd say it's definitely a mixed picture. Climate change, if you follow SEJ conferences, you know, the climate change always gets the big room downstairs. Food issues, sometimes ocean. Toxicology these days, we have to acknowledge, is not really a front burner issue on the environmental beat, and it's too bad because it's so incredibly important. If we think of it more broadly as environmental health, then its profile rises. But toxicology is really at the heart of environmental health science. So we ignore it at our peril. But I think there are reasons why this is such a challenging beat. And that was brought home to me painfully just yesterday when I was dealing with fact checkers from Nature for 5 hours on a tox study yesterday in my hotel room. They weren't there in the hotel room, but it felt that way. It totally felt that way. I felt like I needed to be fully clothed. But anyway, the point is that this is really complicated stuff. It requires a huge amount of explanation, a lot of B matter, which everyone hates, right? Because you're piling in all this sort of background explanation that really makes things hard. The more you do these kinds of stories, the more you realize how incredibly difficult it is to find truly disinterested sources. They basically don't exist. Everyone has an iron in the fire here in one way or the other, whether it's ideologically, whether they're sort of committed to a theory or a hypothesis, or whether it's economic, you know, based on who's paying for the work. We all know that who's paying for the work is not dispositive, but it's one more piece of information that all reporters should have. So that's really frustrating. There's a kind of a feeling that even though, as George Gray pointed out, toxicology by the standards of science is young, by the standards of journalism, a lot of these traditional issues, especially cancer toxicology, you know, standard regulatory toxicology, are kind of old. And it's hard to make them feel fresh sometimes. And then fourthly, sort of related to this problem of finding a disinterested observer, you know, one of the things that you realize when you write about this a lot, and again, this came up a lot with my Nature piece, is that there's a huge disconnect between the world of regulatory toxicology and the broader world of environmental health research. That includes academic toxicology. And sometimes when you're working on a story, you just feel like they're talking two completely different languages. And that can be really frustrating. And I'm particularly frustrated often with the world of regulatory toxicology because so much has happened in the field of tox, yet the systems that we use to evaluate, that the FDA and the EPA actually use to evaluate these products, are so old. They're really mired in some very old ideas. And it comes up all the time. It comes up in the context of that very famous quote from Paracelsus, that the dose makes the poison. That's fine. The dose does make the poison. But the difficulty is that regulatory toxicology traditionally assumes that you can extrapolate smoothly downward from a high dose result and assume that you're going to get predictable results based on a nice even dose response curve. And now we know that for certain kinds of health effects, certain kinds of molecules, you don't get that effect, especially molecules that bind to hormone receptors. You get all kinds of funky effects. So all this is really complicated. And as a result, the stories that come out are often fall into, you know, one of three traps. They're either apocalyptic in the sense that, you know, they're based around one study and are very scare oriented, and really lack full context. You know, it's hard to really know how this risk fits into the broader picture. Or fall into the stenography camp, where you're just like, well, this is too complicated. I can't possibly figure this out. So I'm just going to ping pong quotes back and forth between the advocacy group and the industry group. And and then, you know, I'll wipe my hands and say, okay, I'm done. But you haven't left the reader with anything useful. And then thirdly, I've been seeing more sort of reaction type stories, you know, kind of blowback stories that are all about, you know, especially by my friends who define themselves as science writers as opposed to environmental writers, sort of saying, well, this whole all these toxic issues are really overblown. They're just not that important. The public reacts to them poorly, so therefore we shouldn't write about them. And of course, that's not appropriate either. All three of these are, you know, represent big traps that it's very easy for journalists to fall into. And I think in this room, I see lots of very experienced people who know better. But I also see some younger people, and it's a real problem. And I guess what I would say is that I hope what we're going to talk about today is the only alternative, the fourth path, is to really get into the weeds and put in the time to really understand how the process works. Because the more time you spend actually immersing yourself in it, you don't have to spend 5 years on a book like an academic does, like me, but, you know, you can take the time to read the primary source, talk to the folks involved, and really get into the weeds, because then when you come out of it, you can come out of it with a more confident voice, like Lizzie does in her stories. When Lizzie writes a story, you know, hey, this is a confident person who has a grasp of the science. That's really crucial. So I hope that's what we'll be talking about today.
Okay. So we're going to open it up to questions, starting with me. to get things going, and then we'll go on to others. And when we do later on, remember that it's members, you know, active members of SEJ get the first questions. But I'm going to start out with one that I think a number of newer people to the field might have a problem with, and we're going to ask our experts here how they would deal with it. We've got, like, the findings of a new paper from some federally funded research. It's been published in a peer-reviewed journal by university scientists, and they find evidence suggesting that a widely used plasticizer is toxic. So you call an industry chemist who works on plasticizers, and this person comments that there's a year-old paper by a colleague. You should look at it. You do. It comes to almost the exact opposite conclusion as the new paper. It was funded by industry, for what that's worth. And now you're left as a reporter trying to figure out, what do you make of this? Can both be right? Is one bogus? Is the newer paper more likely to be right than the older one? What kind of guidelines would you give reporters here for trying to make sense of this apparently contradictory information, which we confront all the time? Who wants to take that?
That's a loaded question, and I think it's highly relevant because we're going to see more and more of these kinds of issues emerging. I think initially the key thing is some aspect of scientific repeatability. A lot of these studies, there may be only one paper and it's not repeated in any other laboratory. And, that could create serious concern because, whether it be academics or whether it be, industry, some people have agendas and some people are good scientists. So the way I look at it, all industry science is not bad. There's a lot of good science in industry because all of you depend on chemistry. All of us. Every day. Whether it's deodorants, hair dye, or what. We live in a chemical world. So let's don't say because industry produces it, it's bad. At the same time, we need to understand how to evaluate these chemicals so we don't end up with bad long-term effects, both to our health and to the environment. And I've seen many instances, and the press can have a major play in this. I was past chairman of the scientific advisory panel at EPA, and we would have to deal with issues of the press versus the science versus multiple stakeholders coming in. And so science, I don't care if it's even the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. If it's not repeated anywhere else, it's not necessarily gospel. And the key is to have repeatable science by multiple laboratories. Then you start to have a flavor of, wow, maybe we have something here that's accurate, repeatable, and validated. And if you don't think you've got a piece of science that is at least repeated somewhere else, try to go to an independent objective person. Maybe you establish some relationships. To say, you know, can you give me some background? I get these calls. Can you give me some perspective, some background as what the real truth may be? Is this real or not? From an independent, I have no vested interest. Okay? So, I mean, this is a serious part of our culture now. And as we develop more products and our science is becoming more elegant, we're sequencing DNA, we're looking at inheritable disease tied to chemicals and that can influence us. We're doing some very elegant science now. So the questions are going to become more and more complex. And I think it's a responsibility for not only the scientists such as us to get it right and to report the truth. I think it's a responsibility for you guys to report the truth.
Add one thing about that, maybe. I'm glad that you didn't say if it hasn't been repeated, don't report it, because as journalists, we know that there are multiple reasons why that is highly unlikely, especially in this sort of, you know, incredibly multipolar media world, you know, where there are so many places that could potentially be writing about that. Some of them maybe know what they're talking about. Many of them probably don't. That, you know, I don't think that just taking a pass on a potentially important finding is an option. So at least it often isn't. And the second thing I wanted to say is that Janet's question, you know, could they both be right? I the answer is often yes, but that's not really the right question. I don't think. I think the right question is to understand exactly what question were each of those studies designed to answer. And, you know, there's not, in my experience, there's not a lot of outright fraud in science. There is some, but there's not a lot. But what there is a lot of careful selection of hypotheses, you know, based on who's doing the work and their either ideological or financial agenda. So it's really important when you're in that conflicting situation to try to nail down exactly how the questions, how the study design differed, and then to look for your independent experts to try to get a sense of what's consistent with previous science. Is there a reasonable mechanism, biological mechanism that might explain it? What kinds of vested interests are involved on all sides? And fourthly, just what appears to make sense. And that if you do that and if you put in the time, you can do better than a tennis match story where the reader is just going back and forth, back and forth.
Yeah, I think you've gotten really good advice. This is one of these situations that makes clear just what a hard job journalism is. Because this is, as Janet said, something that confronts people all of the time. And it's really, really difficult. And I think in some ways we're making it more difficult from the scientific side. Dan said there are no distant interested sources. It's universities, you know, my school of public health has just hired a communications director whose job is to try and get things out. And their job is to try and make the things we do sound as interesting as possible. Because the idea is that it helps raise the profile of the school. It may help us with funding. But it's not there necessarily to help with nuance, with uncertainty, with how does this fit into the world that you know, it with the rest of our knowledge. And that is something that makes what you do a real challenge. I think Dan's ideas that you just heard of trying to understand how something is really done, what questions it's trying to answer, and to push a little bit. There is a recent study looking at what was it? There was just with Alzheimer's. Yeah, that's a good one. It was based on in vitro studies. Remember, I said one of the things toxicologists do is study cells. This was done by exposing. It wasn't triclosan. Wasn't bisphenol A. It was one of a fairly high-profile compound. The good thing is obviously it kind of bounced off people. But there was a real effort to make this a big deal. And it turns out that this was a study in which something was being applied directly to cells. And maybe there were changes going on. But there's a long way between the way in which something interacts with the body, moves through the body, gets to the brain, and has an effect that's very different than what happens if you just put it on brain cells. There were some, and I cannot believe my brain's not working, but it could be really signed. But I found there were studies with this Alzheimer's, like it'll come to me later and I'll remind you. The point is that there is a broader world of biology that something kind of has to fit into and makes sense in. And that is actually, I think Dan's idea is great. That's where you find people that you can talk to who aren't on one side or the other of this specific little thing, but are saying, does this result even seem to make sense? And Ron just said, you can call him. He likes to answer those kinds of calls. But it's a challenge that we will continue to face, and we'll continue to face it partially because the research world is going to make it harder for you because they're going to make it harder to tell a big result from a small result.
And the only thing I would add to that is I think as a journalist, assuming that you have more than 175 words allotted to your story, I think it is quite okay and actually really helpful to be able to report uncertainty. And you will find if you actually read the study through, somewhere towards the end in the discussion, not necessarily the conclusion, the authors will often discuss the limitations of their study, and that's a really good place to look to ask the kind of questions that both Dr. Kendall and Dr. Gray have been referring to about study design and, you know, what the study was intended to do and how they did it and where the uncertainties come from. So that's kind of a practical how-to. You don't always have the space to do that. I think the most frightening question I ever got asked was when someone asked me to sort of like report on an actual article I'd written, and their question was, and it was on a broadcast thing, at the top of the hour, do plastics make us fat? And I knew I had 90 seconds, and I was really scrambling. But when you have any more than those 90 seconds to answer that gotcha question, go look at where the study actually talks about its own uncertainties.
I'll add here, too, that even if you don't have room for that in your story, that's something you should be paying attention to just to decide to vet it on your own. When you're trying to decide how do you not overplay or underplay a story, if it turns out that they don't have many confounders that might explain this, it looks pretty strong, then you can feel a little bit more confident. But if they've got, it could be this, or it could have been confounded by this, or we don't know, then you better be a little more cautious. So even if you don't get to put all that into the story directly, it should inform how you approach that story.
I think reporters are more afraid of uncertainty than they should be, really. That editors have this incredible lack of... Oh, you found it? Great.
Yeah, just real quickly. Yes. Cheryl saved me. It's diacetyl or diacetyl,
right,
which is the... it's both used as an artificial butter flavor, but it's also present naturally in a lot of our foods, too. Thank you.
And readers are much more tolerant of uncertainty than editors are. But you can get your editor used to the idea of uncertainty. You can write an interesting, really useful story while still acknowledging the reality that there's very little that we can be sure of in this world. And I think reporters get in a lot more trouble by ignoring uncertainty than they do by overplaying uncertainty and then having their stories buried. We make the first mistake much more, I think.
And can I just add, and one of the things there that is a question is kind of the credibility of reporting when, as science does, things move. Are eggs good for you or bad for you this week? And when people see these changes, they don't necessarily blame the messenger often, not the people who did that work in the beginning. And that's the reason that really taking uncertainty seriously can be a good thing for journalism.
Two questions here.
Janet, can I add one more thing?
I mean, I think the bottom line is toxicology is not an exact science. Now, that's the bottom line. And I can tell you what makes it so difficult for us is that you can have strain differences, you can have sex differences related to how you respond to drugs. And many of you will go to the reception tonight. you can have one glass of wine, and that's too much. Some of you could drink wine all night. Okay? That's, we toxicologically respond differently. So imagine then trying to do experiments to interpret hypotheses on many, many questions that we want to utilize to understand a substance. So it's not an exact science. That's why I emphasize the repeatability of the science. Okay? Being an editor of environmental toxicology and chemistry since 1986, I've seen a lot of science. Okay? And I've seen a lot of good science. I've seen a lot of bad science. And one of the things that really bothers me as a scientist, where somebody comes out with a real sexy title, really, and unrepeated, and then you guys get a hold of it and make, I mean, it's incredible what it can do. Pardon? Yeah. So, I mean, to me, I mean, I've been involved with this before. And then we're trying to figure out what real science is. And the problem is, too, number one, toxicology is not an exact science. Number two, it takes us a lot of time. It takes us time to do the studies, to get them reviewed and published. All right? So it's hard for us to catch up when all of a sudden these breaking issues are occurring. And that's why good scientific judgment, both on reporting as well as interpretation, becomes quite critical in the best and our responsibility to the public.
Okay. First hand up is in the back of the room. Identify yourself, please.
Yeah. Well, I'd respond.
It's a terrific question because really, science builds up replicability. You know, you take a science paper that you might be reporting on, right after you read the introduction says, here's what we're doing, why we're doing it, the very first thing they tell you are the methods, right? Those methods are there so that someone else can repeat it. Now, that happens much less than we might like, but that is a fundamental part of science. How many of you have been following what's going on in the psychology literature? There's a real sense of introspection there because there have been a bunch of studies looking at attempts to replicate very well-known and often very prominent psychological theories that are failing completely. And in fact, Daniel Kahneman, who got the Nobel Prize in 2 years ago maybe, Thinking Fast and Slow, some of you might have seen his work, he's just issued essentially a challenge to the entire psychology community that they have to figure out a different way to do their experiments because of replication error and the fact that there are results getting out that just aren't true. And interestingly, he says, this is probably happening in other parts of science, too, and points to fields like epidemiology and other fields where there's lots of data, where there's a great deal of discretion on the part of the investigator about which data is being used, how it is being manipulated and modeled and such. So this replicability thing is a huge problem. There are also, as Ron mentioned, there are very real differences in model systems. In toxicology, if we're trying to predict what happens in people, we use rodents. I can't tell you before I start whether a mouse or a rat is a better predictor of what happens when I expose you to something. I often get different results from mice and rats. The toxicity of dioxin is over 3,000-fold different between guinea pigs and gerbils. Depending on if you think you're more like a guinea pig or a gerbil, the toxicity of dioxin is very, very different. And many times, unless we know a lot more about what's happening within the biological system, we're stuck with situations like that. One thing toxicologists tend to do is to err on the side of, safety, precaution, when interpreting those data. And the common thing to do in regulatory toxicology that Dan's talked about is to assume that people are like whatever is the most sensitive species. It may be true. It may not be true. There are consequences to assuming things are more toxic than they are, but there are also consequences to assuming that things are less toxic than they are. So replicability has a lot of things going on, but any scientist who says it's because the other guys are incompetent is somebody I would be really, really questioning about.
Yeah, well, that does happen, and I have certainly have made exactly that point in stories or quoted people saying that and tried to test that proposition. The difficulty, what really makes Dan's question difficult, is that it does sound like a really dubious thing to say, like, how could that be true? You're good and everyone else stinks? That can't possibly be true. Except that sometimes things are complicated, and you know, all we have to do is look at, you know, particular examples of people whose work was extremely controversial early, but is significantly less controversial now, or, you know, depending on who you ask. I mean, the early endocrine disruptor work would definitely fall into that category, where there were, you know, where there were alleged replicability efforts, but each of those studies had their own quirks, and then eventually the mass of work built up, and it turned out that, well, there's nuance here, but that, yeah, these subtle EDC effects of EDCs that were spotted by one or two researchers very early turn out to actually be there. Now, whether they're relevant to human health is still something to really to talk about, but the effects were real. And yet early on, everyone said, the vast majority of folks, you know, said, well, those effects aren't real. Well, actually, they were real.
So. There's also cold fusion.
Yeah. Okay, next.
I actually think this is a really important question because this is sort of the other side of what you do. What makes a scientist want to talk to you? And this is a really big deal. I will tell you that I have worked with scientists who will not take calls from journalists. And the interesting thing, one of the important reasons is what they live for, what they get rewarded for, what gives them their psychic feel-goodness at the end of the day has a lot more to do with what their colleagues think of them than what the general public thinks of them. And they fear that in that 170 words that Lizzie can write, they're going to be quoted in a way that may get something across. It may be actually be helpful. But their colleagues will read it and say, how could you say that? Or you left this out. Or you didn't talk about the nuance. You didn't talk about my work or something. They feel like there's more of a downside to them than an upside in working with journalists. And I think it's a real problem. But it is a very real thing. It's one of the reasons that the Society of Toxicology, as I mentioned, has actually made an effort, put together a communications committee. And its job, one of its missions that's been given to it by the leadership of the society, is to figure out how to make interactions between toxicologists and the press work better. But it's a really hard thing to do because there are different motives. And often it's very hard to get people to, I'm of two minds of this, because I actually think it's very important for scientists to engage. At the same time, when I see scientists who are constantly engaging with the press, I think differently about them as scientists. Because it looks to me like they're trying to do their job through the press rather than through traditional scientific channels. And so it making that relationship work is a really hard thing for you, but it's also a hard thing for us. Ron?
I was just going to jump in there, and I think you were asking about your question in the context of new.
I've had that very analogous situation to it, actually, in China. You know, I had a American researcher invite me to go to China to do a piece that I thought was good and fair and interesting, and there were real consequences for that project after my piece appeared, and we were all shocked by that. But we shouldn't have been, I guess, because particularly in a closed society, but we have our own version of that here in the States. You know, there are real consequences sometimes with working with a reporter. And as reporters, it's really important that we be aware of that and that, you know, we not do the sort of Janet Malcolm, you know, sort of misleading our sources, but that we're very clear and upfront about the possible things that might go wrong depending on the circumstance.
Well, I think animal studies are vital for our interpretation of the effects of chemicals on human health. I mean, literally. To do all of the work in using just cells or using models is just not adequate. We have a lot of data to prove that. So I think animal studies are a component of that. We generally run a lot of statistics now in preparing for an animal study so we can, what we do, a power analysis to project the number of animals that we would need to have appropriate statistical power and therefore limiting the number of animals. I think there's a lot more attention to those kind of details now than, say, 20 years ago. At the same time, I think the whole animal study context is a critical component of the overall toxicological assessment of chemicals, particularly for human health.
Sure. Can I just, so what I wanted to jump in, though, and say is that, I mean, I mentioned earlier, toxicologists, we're sort of often trying to look forward. There are requirements for toxicology tests to be done for a pesticide to be registered or for a drug to be used. And those are based on animal studies. We know they're not perfect. We are not mice. They are studying a different species and under different conditions. The animals live in their little cages. They don't do the things. They don't eat a good diet or a bad diet. They don't smoke or not smoke. They don't exercise or not exercise, all the things that we do that can actually influence our responses. So toxicology is actually answering a very specific narrow question. What actually happens to these animals? There's then the next step that goes into what Dan mentioned, sort of regulatory toxicology. I'm also here not only from SOT, but I'm the incoming president of the Society for Risk Analysis. And these, again, are government, industry, and academic people who think about how we take that information from those animal tests, for example, and use it to make important decisions. Do we allow this drug on the market? Is this a pesticide that shouldn't be used in homes? In reporting about that, it's really important, I believe, to make clear that that the information we have is based on a different species than the one we care about in this case. Unless, you know, I mean, Ron cares about, a lot of his work is about the actual species you might be testing. For human health, it's usually a different species. And I think being very clear about where those data come from, the fact that we know of things like, we know of chemicals where effects happen in animals that don't happen in people. And unfortunately, we know a few examples of situations where things appear to happen in people, like cancer from arsenic, that are almost impossible to make happen in animals. So they're not perfect models for us. It may or it may not be. I mean, it's a challenge we face. When things go into this regulatory arena, there are kind of rules set up for how people use those data. But as I mentioned, they're rules that aren't necessarily, they're getting specifically away from science and getting into a realm that people often call science policy, where they say, if I have animal data, I'm going to assume that people are like the most sensitive animal that I tested. And in fact, we'll assume that if we saw an effect in animals, it will happen. That isn't directly science, but those are choices that are made about how we're going to use it. And those, explaining those is a really hard thing to do in a news story. Ron's
got it. Yeah, you're taking us more into defining risk of chemicals. And risk implies understanding the dose and understanding the effects. And the effects involves animal studies, epidemiology perhaps, molecular biology testing, or just computer modeling. The dose or exposure gets into more of the environmental chemistry and so on. So what we try to do in the United States is bring these data together so we can create a risk profile on the chemical, because literally anything can be toxic if you get enough dose. You can drink enough water to kill you. Seriously. I'm dead serious. So you got to understand dose makes the poison. And as we start to look through a risk profile of a chemical, we're trying to look at effects data tied to dose.
Okay. And I just one quick thing that I would just sort of say again from a reporting point of view to the question about interpretation. Again, I think I can't emphasize enough how much context is important and how much you can actually ask the scientists who did the study, can you explain this to me? And if they can't, that might be a good sign that you maybe should look for some other sources before you sort of bank on this as sort of something you want to pin a story to. But again, I think the context is really important to get out of what you're trying to look at.
And the last thing to keep in mind when somebody tells you that, well, mice aren't people. Yes, we know mice aren't people, but we don't do controlled experiments on human beings. We really have a very limited palette of evidence that we can choose from, you know, or that we could draw from. We've got disease patterns. That's the world of epidemiology. We have horrible accidents, that occur, and then we try to make sense of those, but we don't control for other kinds of exposures when there are those accidents. And we have animal testing, and we also have mathematical modeling. None of them are good, really. None of them are anywhere what we would like them to be. But we may never know what the actual result is in humans. We may never be able to get at that question. So as a reporter, when you hear somebody say, well, this is only an animal study or this is only a modeling study, true, you should point that out. But that is no reason not to do the story. Because often this is all the evidence that we will ever have. And in the world of environmental health, we make decisions based on inadequate evidence, always. The core question is never, when will we get enough evidence? Because we will never have enough evidence. The core question is, what do we do given the evidence that we have? That's what really matters.
Also, in human studies, you're almost always stuck with correlation.
Yeah, I figured that we would get this question. So, there was just a previous session an hour ago that I was at in which the whole point was to introduce a wide variety of tox databases, some of which I knew and some of which I didn't. They were mostly related to the NLM, which is, you know, a wonderful National Library of Medicine, a wonderful resource. And the person who presented that is Phil Wexler. Is he in the room? Okay, there he is. So I'm going to take the liberty of, I hope Phil's not going to kill me, but I'm going to take the liberty of giving you Phil's email, and not to answer individual questions, but I bet that Phil would be willing to send you his PowerPoint. And it's wexlerp@mail.nih.gov. And he really did a great job of introducing a number of really useful tox databases. And Phil, am I correct that you'd be willing to send people the PowerPoint version? Too late now if you're not. It was great. And we all really do. It's really important to keep looking for other resources because we all tend to fall into our patterns of going by our old standbys and, you know, searching through the literature in specific ways. And that can be a trap. And it's really important to continually look for new places.
And in addition, I'll just add one other resource, which will not duplicate what Dan mentioned, which is in looking for scientists to interview who are really good sources who may not have been involved with the study. And Marla Cohn is in the back of the room, and this is not just to cheer Marla up back there, but Environmental Health News has a phenomenal set of resources, not only through their website and everything that links to, but also through their science communication fellows who are primarily kind of up-and-coming scientists. Some of them actually are some of the experts in different areas of research. And I found them to be terrific contextual sources who may not have been involved in the particular study, but I feel like really solid about going to them. And they've been trained to talk to journalists.
Right. And I should say, too, that as a model for journalists, I mean, I don't want to make Marla feel old, but I'm pretty old, and she was a mentor for me. Maybe really the most important mentor that I would look to see, okay, how can you write about tox in a way that is not just stenography, but also it doesn't just scare the bejesus out of you, but does recognize the reality of the risks that are out there. And so I would just encourage anyone to look through Marla's, oeuvre over the decades, because she does it better than anyone.
I guess the first thing that I would say that's one of the beauties of online reporting these days is that, as Rebecca suggested, you don't actually have room to go into the whole explanation, but this is a place where it's a hyperlink will really help you out. But I've really pushed on that part because you're reporting an industrial accident, and I've done a number of these stories, and the real question everybody wants to know is, you know, is this scary? Is this important? What are the health effects? And I think if you don't push as far as you can to explain these things in some detail, you end up with a story that is, Dan would say, is going to scare the bejesus out of you, when that may or may not be necessary. But I think that's a place where maybe take a couple lines out of something else, make it clear that you can link to some sources. But I think that's a really crucial part of those stories.
And when you do those two sentences, or however much you can fight your editor to give you, Lizzie's idea of linking out is great. That's a huge help. Don't ignore acute effects. You know, everyone always wants to know. The editor always wants to know, well, is it a carcinogen, you know? Well, if it is or it isn't a carcinogen, may or may not be, it is unlikely to be the crucial factor at that moment. Instead, people are really should be focused on the acute effects. So don't ignore the short-term effects, too. It used to be the opposite. 100 years ago, nobody knew about chronic effects, and we would only focus on acute poisoning. Now, often we have the opposite problem, that we're so consumed with long-term effects that we don't spend enough time thinking about, okay, well, what are the short-term acute effects, which can be very serious.
Now, that's a really good question, and it's a situation that's it's got to be kind of juicy and interesting to you, because this looks like, you know, this is a science food fight that's kind of taking place out in the public, and that's interesting stuff. And yet, in some ways, the resolution of this is going to end up being a scientific question. It's going to be a matter of, let's figure out if there are new things that we have to test for, if there are new ways in which we have to test things. And it's a real tension, and part of it goes back to something that Dan mentioned, this idea of regulatory toxicology. There has been built up over the years an approach that regulators have become very comfortable with, and these are regulators in EPA and regulators in FDA, are very comfortable with, when I've made decisions with these kinds of tests, in the past, it really hasn't come back to bite me. And so I'm pretty comfortable that if I've got this kind of information, and I process it in the way that I always have, I'll come to a decision that both I'm going to be comfortable with as a public servant, and I know it's probably going to stand up in court. So they're pretty happy with that. And then when there's pressure from outside that's saying, no, 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 you're not doing the right things, you're not measuring the right things, it's hard for them to change. So that in many ways, this is a conflict between regulatory toxicology and the way in which this information is brought into a decision-making process. So in some ways, it's not about the actual experiments that are done, it's about how it's processed and used to say, is this drug okay? Is a pesticide okay? What do we do with this? And I actually believe that this will be worked out in the scientific community, but it'll take a little while. And I think that it's starting off in some ways in kind of an unfortunate position, and then it's really being posed as it's really being set up as two groups of scientists in opposition. Yeah, and and it shouldn't be a mortal combat. I think it's something they can sit down and work out over drinks. But I mean, we can be a lot friendlier about it than it's been set up. But it's an important question, but you have to recognize that a large part of it is driven by this history and use of toxicology in a regulatory setting.
It is an opportunity for journalism too, very much of one. You know, sorry. Okay, I'm talking too much, but thank you for teeing up my story. In Nature next week, which is about exactly this. So appreciate that. I need every click I can get. I think it's behind a paywall. Anyway. Yeah, sorry, it's behind a paywall. Well, I'll try to break the paywall somehow. But the point is that for us, that's good. Disagreement is good. As long as, again, we don't treat it just as a tennis match, but we try to understand what's really going on. And understand the differences. I totally agree with George that this is not really about toxicology versus endocrinology or toxicology versus the reproductive biologist. It's really about this problem of regulatory science, which is its own somewhat archaic world.
And I was just going to say that I think it's a really fertile ground for stories, and not just as a he said, she said story, but really looking at how over time regulation and regulatory toxicology are struggling to catch up with the emerging science and what that has led to in terms of all sorts of things that are playing out. Well, I think that's just a really wonderfully interesting sort of intersection to write about. And, I mean, as George Gray said, that is where things are going to evolve. And, I mean, in terms of narrative and stories, again, it's a really...
And can I just say, there's the flip side. It sort of dance blowback things. There are also going to be things where we said this was going to be a big problem, and it's really not. Yep. Just kidding.
Yeah.
And I will tell you, from being inside an agency... Nobody in EPA or FDA or in any agency around the world wants to do things that are going to hurt people. That's not why they're there. That's not what they want to do. But you get very caught up in the way in which you've always done things, which makes you very comfortable about the way you use data and make decisions, and change is really hard. And yet, if change is important for actually getting the public health outcomes that we all want, it's got to happen. And there isn't a good example in my mind of place where it's happening.
Also, you have to vet the new tests, over time, and sometimes you know that you're getting certain findings, but if you don't have a long track record, you just don't know how reliable they are. So the regulators are dubious about relying on them, even though the scientific community says, look, we're getting consistent, data for the last few years. So that they will be trying to pull the regulators, along, and it will take a while for the regulations to catch up, which is probably a conservative or healthy.
Can I comment on? Christy, the whole area of human testing. When I was serving as chairman of the science advisory panel at EPA, we had to bring both the science advisory board and the science advisory panel together to address human testing. I chaired some of those early sessions. That was the most controversial subject I've ever handled. It's very passionate. There are a lot of ethics involved, and so. When you get into that arena, both from a scientific and a public perspective, it gets kind of crazy. I mean, the logic goes out the window. And so to espouse that concept of human subjects for testing of chemical treatment strategies, I don't think will be well received.
But I think there's a slightly different thing going here, which is, this question of when we make decisions, when we take science, so our scientists do the science, and sort of if we think about our toxicology in isolation, that's the science. Then we want to use it, because we want to use it to do things that we care about, protecting human health and the environment, right? So, but that now, it has this processing step involved. And it's got a decision-making step that's got a pretty strong values component to it. So in the drug decision-making world for a long time, the value decision that was made by FDA was, we want to make sure something is absolutely completely safe before we put it out on the market. And what the AIDS situation and HIV activists made happen is people said, no, wait a minute. While you're waiting forever to figure out if this stuff is absolutely perfectly safe, my friends and I are dying. You are, by your decision-making rules, you're keeping valuable things that may have real benefits to us away from us. And in fact, we're willing to perhaps take on some of that risk. And legislation was changed, and there are fast tracks for certain kinds of drugs, for certain kinds of conditions. Almost everything that we're talking about that's out there and we're worried about toxicologically, whether it's a new product or an old product, at some level has some degree of benefit. And this question of what are the benefits and what are we giving up with the way in which we're processing and using the information, is a conversation we haven't had very much in the toxicology world. I don't know if it'll come. But there are situations we know where this is slightly, say vaccines and autism. there are real consequences, public health consequences, to the way in which we inform people and they take on board controversial scientific information. And, you know, it's one of the hardest things, I think, to probably report, but it's also one of the things that you guys can do best, because it's making sure that conversation is happening, at least.
I want to comment. That's a good point. Very good point. I want to go back to the endocrine disruptor area, because we're still under development in this whole arena. And I wanted you just to have some perspective on it. The Food Quality Protection Act was passed in 1996 by Congress, okay? And that set the stage for testing substances for endocrine disruption. And as EPA science panel chair, we started getting a lot of these proposed test ideas, but you brought about the conflict between endocrinology and toxicology. And that conflict was serious and still significant. After the Food Quality Protection Act was passed, the EPA created an endocrine disruptor screening and testing advisory committee called EDSTAT. I sat on that. The endocrinologists thought at that time very differently, okay, than the toxicologists. And as all of these ideas and proposed tests were brought to the table, I realized there was very complicated discussion that was going to have to occur. Now, approaching 20 years later, we're still trying to implement these tests. Some of them implemented, some are still being evaluated, but to say it's complex, it's an understatement. And so this is going to be very fertile ground to report on, because even Europe is battling this. From some countries are looking at it very differently than other countries in Europe, okay, as to their ethics and their how they consider these issues. So this takes me back to that whole subject of the interface of these scientific issues from endocrine issues to toxicological endpoints, et cetera, et cetera. It's complex. It's controversial. A lot of that science is yet to be fully revealed and validated. And so it's going to be an area that I say will continue to be a challenge to report on and a challenge to interpret. And just get ready for the ride. It's going to be bumpy.
But for us as reporters, I mean, that EDSTAC process is a great example. I mean, here we are 20-plus years later, and we still more or less have the same testing regime. There are a few changes, but more or less have the same testing regime that we had when EDSTAC started. And it just goes to show you that the regulatory world just works. It really doesn't work. I mean, it just really doesn't work. Often, I mean, what has happened now and what reporters will increasingly be writing about, I think, are efforts that sort of move outside the regulatory regime and instead are oriented more toward, disclosure. You know, okay, we're going to disclose an effect even if we don't understand what the effect means and leave it up to the researcher, leave it up to the consumer, or maybe we're going to move toward green chemistry and even if we don't know for sure what effects are, we're going to look at alternatives and see if there are better alternatives. Because waiting on the regulatory process it's just, you know, you'll be waiting forever.
You got 30 seconds.
And just one 30-second suggestion. If you're reporting on this, remember that in a lot of cases, the market is moving much faster than regulation, responding to toxicological science much faster than the regulatory community. So keep an eye on that as well.
Thank you, guys. Great panel.